Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
Were you still in high school, or was it like?
No, I'd graduated high school. I tried college, and
right. I have one other friend who has that trajectory, and he was actually the first person to make an amends to me. I was like still in college, and it's this guy that, you know, got addicted to heroin in high school, and he had started like a year at UCLA and then bombed out. And but anyway, I just remember it being so profound to see him do it. So okay, that for him, he must have been like 21 or 22 when he got sober, and then I got sober at like 31. And so 10 years later, I was thinking back to that day of like, you know, clearly this friend of mine was ahead of the curve. You know, he knew something that we didn't. I'm gonna kind of like phrase/paraphrase from Alan's book. When he talks about forgiveness in his 12 Essential Insights, it's you know, the carrot is recovering our ability to claim the experience we've had rather than letting the experience overwhelm or claim us. Forgiveness helps us take back our power and recover our emotional balance. It helps us regain our emotional center of gravity. The grievance itself, the thing that, you know, we're seeking to forgive, is the result of four experiences. The first experience is we took the offense too personally. The second is we blamed the offender for how we felt. Third, we created a grievance story. The fourth thing is finally the tragic event violated one of our unenforceable rules, leaving us with a sense of being betrayed on a fundamental level. A lot of this comes back to, as with much of emotional sobriety, the violation of our unenforceable rules. There's the should that's underlying whatever the disturbance is that we have that we need to disentangle somehow.
The should is that it shouldn't happen to me, right? Like somehow I'm exempt from life in that I somehow got a pass on, you know, tough and sometimes devastating experiences, right? And that was the kind of the big hurdle, which was that life happens. Sometimes really horrible life stuff happens, but what am I going to do about it, right? Can I turn that experience around? So that was the big lesson for me in all of that was even as something as fundamental as, you know, your parents are there to love and protect and provide for you. And if that doesn't happen, the chain of events that cascade off of that are pretty tough to overcome. But the fact is, like, my parents didn't have the skills to provide that fundamental requirement for raising a child in a healthy manner. So what, right? You know, I could sit there and be in pain and be in blame for, you know, the rest of my life and never move past it. Or I could start to look towards healing and accept that the should was just a blocker for me.
You know, Tom, like I think you're a really impressive person. And I was talking about my parents actually recently with somebody and their failings, quote unquote. And I found myself saying that, like, if I have some gratitude for my life, or if I feel kind of like okay or even grateful about being here, I have to assume my parents had some part in that, even if it was only biological. You know, I think that, like, part of like forgiving them their shortcomings or whatever, you know, it's all the other stuff, all the usual stuff. They were doing the best they could. I could find some gratitude even when they were giving me the least. Did you land on something like that eventually with all that you had to go through? Or
yes, I did. What I didn't like, you know, so this is stages and it's progression of forgiveness. It's not a fixed point in time. Is that you know, I need to be upset about it, you know, like I need to be angry, I need to grieve my childhood and, you know, and the lack of what, you know, loving, nurturing parents that I was looking for. I couldn't bypass that. I tried, it didn't work, right? And one of my peeves is when people in 12-step recovery and will go, well, they did the best they could with what they had, and then bypass the process behind it, right? I had to go through the whole thing. I'm like, you know, you gotta dig up the body and you gotta exhume it and you At least
Well,
enough.
that's where, yeah, that's, I mean, that's where Alan, it's funny, the contrast of Alan and I, forgiveness is not something we do. It's our natural state when we're not holding on to old pain. You go with what is natural, and that's how you get there. It's a nice, so you're describing, that's why I say it's not something you do. It's something you make yourself available for, and you did that by letting yourself have all those feelings. Not taking those away from yourself. And you probably had somebody to help you or somebody say something to give you that option that you didn't have to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had an interesting process with my mom in particular because, my mom was an a active alcoholic and, had other conditions and demons that she dealt with, at different stages of my childhood. So, I went through the mourning process of, not having the mother I thought I should, right? And in some cases I needed. Then learned how to, at the time it's called self-parenting, kind of that concept of like, okay, well, no one else is taking care of me. I need to take care of myself. How do I do that emotionally? And get to a place of feeling the self-worth and self-esteem that might have came from, a different experience. And then what happened was, I had about 10 years in the program in recovery, and my mom got sober, right? And so I got excited. I'm like, oh, I'm going to get the mom I always wanted. And that child came back and was like, okay, where's mommy? And she became a sober woman and a new sober mom in a way which didn't fit the story that I had about how she should have been in a replacement for the one I was yearning for
Yeah,
as a
that's
child.
great. She never
And so,
became a sober mom for that child, did she?
no, she
Yeah.
became a sober mom for me in the current. And so I had to go through another round of forgiveness for, for her not being, that version that I, that child was looking for. But I got a great sober mom, right, in the current day. So it's like I lost my mom twice. I lost, lost the one in childhood, then I lost the image and the, the should of the one when I thought she would be when she came into recovery.
But I love the part. This is a great little, just a statement for anybody who's been in recovery a while, and we notice that after a while it's just one thing after a fucking another that we have to go deal with, and so here's Tom walking along. He's done all this forgiveness and stuff like that. His mom gets sober and he goes like, oh crap, I gotta go back and forgive again. It's like, all right, pack up the bag, we gotta get going. It's like, but we do it, and that's where the opportunities are. It's like, okay, and I always hate those people that tell me when I'm in it, oh, this is actually an opportunity for you to do this. So just shut the hell up. It's like, don't tell me this is an opportunity. But of course, with hindsight, it is. I've always been interested in the term active alcoholic. I go like, because I was never a really active alcoholic. I was really, that's, I sat around a lot. I just there was a lot of just sedentary time, you couldn't have described me as an active alcoholic.
Yeah, I hated stairs when I was drinking a lot,
Yeah,
stuff
dangerous, dangerous.
stick.
We were not all stupid. We're dumb when we're drinking, but we're not all stupid.
Was it nice going to meetings with your mom? I would love to be able to share some of the recovery stuff I do with my parents. They are very much not sober. I don't know. I always think whenever I see those kinds of families that are all doing it together, I always think that's really cool.
It's a wonderful experience. What was neat was that I brought her to her first meeting after some wrangling, right? She wasn't ready at the time, but she'd said she'd, she'd finally go to a meeting. And in my head, I'm going like, oh, like, do I got to bring her to meetings all the time now? How am I going to disengage? Trying to practice my Al-Anon. And I get her to the door of the first meeting, and there's Kathy A, who is her neighbor from like two doors down, a contemporary in terms of age. They lived in the same neighborhood for 30 years or something. So in a way, I was able to just hand her over to Kathy, and Kathy took her under her wing, and I didn't have to be concerned with, is she going to meetings? Do I need to take her around? How do I separate my meetings from her meet? And she became her own self in recovery, and then going to meetings together, and like celebrations and all that, and giving her coin and vice versa. It's been really sweet.
That's, I love those stories. It also reminds me of all the people that I've worked with through the years that go like when we're talking about their resistance to AA, they go, well, I might see somebody I know there. You go like, yeah, then they're probably waiting for you,
Yeah,
you know?
they're well aware. Yeah.
They're tapping their watch like any day.
They're gonna be relieved when you walk in the room. Go, oh, thank God you made it.
Tom, I thought it was so beautiful when you said that forgiveness is a natural state when we're not holding on to old pain. Where'd you get that?
I made it
The
up.
nutshell.
It's
But I mean,
like
the
I'm
idea
sure
that
I'm
like
not the only person who ever thought it, but I
sure.
did write it down. I did write that sentence down when I was writing the forgiveness book. Yeah.
My experience is that, hanging on to the pain in a way gives me my identity and my, in this, like a little
Oh, yeah.
boiling cauldron of anger to tap into, and that is familiar, but it's poison.
This whole process of sobriety, whether it be from drugs and alcohol or whether it be from toxic parts of ourselves or whatever, how we get physically and emotionally sober, it's like we're constantly being challenged to let go of things that we never thought of necessarily, but are now we do recognize, if at least with hindsight, if not before, that we have just so attached to our identity. You know, I mean, there were so many things that it was easiest to do the drinking part. It's like, that was such a part of my definition of myself. It's like, I honestly thought when I stopped drinking for a long time, I thought, well, I got nothing. It's like, I mean, it felt like I was giving up my personality. I didn't think I was ever gonna want to have a conversation again. I didn't think I was ever gonna say anything funny again. It's like, I didn't ever think I was gonna think something was funny again. It's like, and it was, and we, we can kind of, we can, the three of us could definitely get it and chuckle with that now, but that's huge,
That's so amazing. I mean, that's amazing to me just because of how your humor and your communication and whatnot, and like these are such quintessential Tom qualities,
Well, there was none of
yeah, but at the time
that.
you thought those were completely absent.
Well, not
Well, I
only did
thought no, I thought they were all completely associated with drinking.
Oh
It's
yeah.
like I mean, you could have put a glass in my hand that I thought had scotch in it, and it would have been like putting a battery in a toy. It's like before I even drank it, my personality would have changed. Because I thought it, because what I realize now, it wasn't the alcohol itself, it was that identity, that belief. So you give me something that I think is a drink, and all of a sudden I'm gonna become the life at the party.
My last name is Potash, right? So it's like, I embraced the pothead,
Oh, that's
identity
perfect.
for quite a while. And then it turned into other drugs in which were not so much fun and happy go lucky. But again, it was like my identity wrapped around my alcoholic addicted self, really struck home for me at one point where I was out buying a Christmas gift for some friends. And you ever see those wire figurines at the mall, like or at a crafts sale, where they take like wire and nuts and bolts and they make figurine. And so I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh, that I'll get that for Dan. He plays piano, and I'm like, who am I? I don't have a
We're trying to find you in there, yeah.
and I
How
was like,
am I wired?
yeah, exactly. What's in a way, at the time, I felt bad. I felt, empty, that I'm like, oh man, I got to rebuild my personality. Like, who am I without that, that part of myself? And eventually, I found it, and developed it. The other piece of it was later on, it was like, who am I going to be without this anger, right? Letting go, if I forgive everybody, and I believe that's possible, who am I without anger, right? Like, I had about, I'd say about 10, 12 years in the program, and I had what I considered a good program, and spiritual practice and all that, but I just still felt like I was dragging around these, heavy chains of, resentment. And, it was my parents and my abuser. And and once I came to the realization that I could forgive, that it was my option, that it was actually for my
choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a choice. And then I could stop hurting everyone else around me if I was not quite so angry. Then that's where the healing started.
Well, let's go to the identity thing too, because that, and we can tie that into the whole for at least certainly self forgiveness, because we got to look at that stuff and about identity. And it's like, I had a therapist. We didn't use the word anger, but of course this is rebellion and anger are very close cousins, if not the same. But I had a therapist that pointed out to me, because I wanted less than anything else would be to be controlled by another person, by anybody to control me. And she told me one day, she always had things, way of turning shit I said against me. She said, which was later for me, but she said, Tom, you're as controlled by your rebellion as anybody else is by, and we weren't using that term at the time, but what we would use, I would use the should monster. She says, you define yourself against everything. You're not making decisions about what you want. I don't know what she said, but this is what I got out of it. It's like, it makes perfect sense to me now. And it's like, you're basically understanding what you're seeing or having an understanding of it. And then you're opposing it, and then like what you're talking about with the identity, Tom, with the anger, it's like, and then she said, I do remember she used these words. She said, then you're digging in, and that's where it's like, that, what is that? That's fucking panic. That, who the hell would I be if I weren't there? And the way I'm a cool guy is I can just be mad and stand up to people and tell them what I think, and, truth, justice, and Tom's way.
It's conformist contrarianism.
That's it.
Yeah.
And all of that, and this, by the way, goes to what we're talking about too, is the, all of that, having a therapist that could do stuff like that, she just took what I, thought was working, or unconsciously thought was working, and she just would shake it up, turn it up. And that's what happens to all of us in this. When we're talking about not knowing who we are, you not knowing who you are without your anger, I'm not knowing who I am without alcohol. It's like, I mean, nobody can tell us that at the time, and it's not really not very polite to do it. You got to take the puzzle we've put together and just dump out the pieces again. We're gonna start over, in so many ways. So it's one of those wonderful paradoxes. I'm exactly the same as I was then, and I am entirely different.
Well, what this brings to mind, both of your shares, is I forgave my high school bully. And we hang out now. We have an out of town friend who's visiting, and I got us an Airbnb, so we can all kind of have a place to hang out near his hotel in a couple weeks. And but like, there was some time in like my sophomore and junior year of high school when he was a member of my friend group, and we would all do drugs and hang out together. That I was just the punching bag. That he would make me feel small. I would have done anything to get away from this guy, but to get away from this guy would have mean cutting my lifeline to all my other friends that I would see day in and day out. And and I think, to his credit, in the last few years, and especially after I found sobriety, he reached out to me like more than once to make his own amends and to try and kind of like address. He was in a lot of pain and suffering from his own kind of demons while he was doing that, and that putting me down in those days was a way of puffing himself up.
You know, we don't control other people. We know that. We got that. We repeat that. We tell each other that. We curse that. We do all that. We do influence people. We do, you know, and the way we influence people is by being better ourselves, by, you know, inside out change. And I don't know if this is the case, but it certainly, if it's not in your situation with your former bully, it is with lots and lots of other people. Is intimacy, if I said the principle, what would it be? The principle would be intimacy begets intimacy. It's like if your intimacy is my definition of intimacy, and it's like if you're sharing from a different place, and I don't mean like, oh, just here, I'm gonna come into my friend group and tell my story, but if you're just being better, you're being deeper, you're telling, you know, you're basically speaking from your heart, it's like other people around you are gonna, you know, not all of them, but some of them are gonna pick up on it. And they're not necessarily going to think, oh, well, that's a great idea that Patrick's doing. We all have that natural need for that kind of intimate connection. What we're doing is we're making ourselves safe people, you know, and that's, you know, and by the way, I got just in terms of my intrapersonal work, a guy on my committee began talking as soon as you talked about your bully. And he's still yakking at me. He's going like, no. Here's the deal. This is the way he always talks. Very conspiratorial. He goes, all right, no. Now he's looking all side to side. He goes, don't blow it for Patrick, because, you know, Patrick's got this bully in a long con. He's bringing him in. He's getting him to feel safe, lulling him into a false sense of confidence. And then we're going off on that weekend, and you won't believe what's going to happen. It's all coming home, baby. It's like, that's the guy I'm telling, you know, have a seat. We're all right. I'll tell them you said that. Okay. Now he's pleased.
What you said, Patrick, about, realizing that it maybe wasn't him specifically, an exercise I take, people through in their resentments and fourth and fifth step is, what if you swap out the name, right? Like, I hate Jim because Jim did this to me, right? Well, what happens if you swap out the name, right? Is it a different, you know, if you swap out the person, is the feeling still the same? Is the resentment still the same? Then it has nothing to do with the person, right? Mm-hmm. It's the, the unenforceable rule or the act or the way I reacted, my feelings towards what happened, that is at stake here. And how do I then look at that in the vacuum? Let the person go, because they were just a catalyst for the event. But what was the event or emotion behind it that's causing, you know, the conflict?
That grievance that I was holding on to, that pain that was blocking me from forgiving, I mean, the sum of it was, this person made me feel a part of, this person made me feel worthless, this person made me feel, but he didn't. Like, he didn't make me feel that. I was like participating in that arrangement. When I let go of that pain, or I was, you know, got into that process, there was like this whole kind of, this trap door with all this, like, you know, poison that just kind of fell out of me once I, you know, realized that, like, for years and years, you know, I for whatever reason, I thought that it would be more advantageous for me to put it on him. And crazy how that works, huh?
Well, the other thing is, and you know, this is, it did for a while. You know, I'm always pointing out to people all the time because actually, when we're, you know, we abuse ourselves in layers. If we're not careful, when we start talking to somebody about self-forgiveness or forgiveness, they'll start beating themselves up for not having forgiven themselves earlier. It's like, you're kind of missing the point. Now you're beating yourself up for beating yourself up. And, you know, and that's where that principle, that nutshell comes in that I have on big letters on my wall in my therapy room, which is never I call it an essential lesson. It's never evaluate yourself according an earlier version of yourself according to what you know now. I mean, that means me yesterday. I mean, it's like this stuff when we're talking about, when Tom and I are talking about our mamas, it's like, you know, if I were to judge my 55-year-old self, according to what I feel and believe right now, what I feel like I'm capable of doing, it's like he would, in terms of how he was doing with his relationship with his mother, he would not come out well. It's like, I mean, that's 15 years. It's like, that's different. It's like, but that's not fair, you know, because I remember being 55 and I remember that I was doing what I could do. And what the message we want to say in terms of taking care of ourselves, being compassionate caregivers for ourselves is, honey, that's fine. That was what you could do that day and you did it. You know, congratulations. You know, we can do it. We can do things differently today if we want to.
Yeah. You know what? You know why? If you want to know if that was the best you could have done at the time, well, it's what you did at the time, right? Like that's
right. Beautiful. Yeah.
Is that the best you could have done? Yeah. Because that's what I did. That's the capacity I had at that time. Even if I like knowingly wanted to do better and I still fell short, but that's the energy and the consciousness that I could generate at the time to
right. Or if I instead of forgiving the person, I sat down and talked to him with that intent, and I ended up screaming at him. It's like okay, nobody does bad on purpose. Nobody intends. I'm gonna go in here and fuck this up. You know, it's like, we don't do that. It's like, now what we can do is if we be kind to ourselves, we can realize, wow, I had a lot to learn at that point, you know, and I'm really glad that I have learned it. But also realize at the same time that just like there are things when I was 55 that I know now that I didn't know then, there are things that I'm going to know in the future that I don't know now. So that's the openness to learning. That's life is about learning. It's like, I can't tell you what the things let's meet back here in 5 years and talk about what we've learned from this day forward. It's like, well, none of us can do that because we haven't had that experience yet. We're always trying, you know, that prophet in our head is always trying to protect us by predicting what's going to happen. You know, and telling us everything, including what we should do in the future, it's wasted energy.
Forgiveness is something you come to more organically. Is that safe to say?
For me, it is. That makes sense. That's a good way to say it.
Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly.
As
the term.
And either way is the best you could do at that time. And now sometimes that I do things that are uncomfortable, but I believe is the right thing. It's a difference between planting my boot in the back of my younger self and kind of nudging forward, straightening my leg and putting it out there and kicking my own ass. It's like kicking my own ass, it doesn't work. It's like, you know, but the idea, there are lots and lots of times where I need a lot of nudging to get out there and try different things. And it's like, and that's okay. But the thing about it is, if I'm resisting the nudge, with the part of me that's got that boot planted in my rear end to do that is not going to judge me. And if I'm saying that's as far as I'm going to go today, and that's as far as I'm going to go today, that's that. Ultimately, it's the inner parent that basically says, "Okay, well, good job, you did something today."
The tools I used for forgiveness, the prayer of St. Francis, right? It really helped me kind of flip my perception of my relationships, and in a way, were a meditation and an intention on, you know, changing my outlook. Loving kindness prayer or meditation, idea, you know, Al mentioned it, you know, what's my unenforceable rule, and things like, you know, gaining perspective, right? You know, long view, you know, am I going to hold somebody responsible for a moment in time for decades, right? You know, I'm only here for a short period of time. Do I want to continue to hold them hostage over, you know, this experience? So it was just a series of, you know, changes in perception and practices, which, and then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I don't feel that way anymore. Right. You know, and it's a slowly softening process to, you know, smooth the edges of, you know, I describe it as like, I used to be a jagged rock that you'd step into a river or a creek and you'd cut your would open on. I was that jagged rock, and if over time I've smoothed over, my edges and the water recovery has helped me.
Well, I know, I'll see you at Metaphors Anonymous, but it's like, of course, I won't see you there because I'm not going. It's like, I refuse. What you just described, though, is just in the subtle part of what you just did, where you were doing your little, and we're doing our little plays, we're playing these things out, and you go, oh, and it's like when we surprise ourselves. That's how this happens. This is shit. Like I had a client last night who just did some. He texted me. She'd done some unbelievable, brave things to let somebody else or let other people into her world because isolation was the way she kept herself safe. It's like and she and I told her, I said, your fear is gonna your fear will fade, but it's gonna be a long time for the fear phase after you do this. And she wrote back after, or she did the challenge, or she challenged herself to let this person in on her life. And she said, "You promised that the fear is going to fade." And of course, what I did was what I always hated other people to do in a way, which is said, "Yes, I do promise that." And it's going to be a long time. So the truth is, she's not going to know. Oh, that's over now. Insights that come with hindsight. That's what you were describing, Tom, where you're walking along,
Absolutely.
dum da dum dum dum, and you realize, huh, I haven't thought like, I haven't been a jagged rock for months.
You give the impression to people that this stuff isn't easy, it's like a challenging process, but that it's not, these issues aren't insurmountable. Like it's a very tolerable level of work that, and be
Well,
evidenced by the fact that you've done it, like you've walked through these places.
Yeah, and it has, because what people don't get sometimes, one of the things I put in the fear book is that, without meaning to, it with the intent to reassure people when they express a fear, we either minimize or criticize. We either say, oh, that's not that big a deal to make them all feel better, or we're saying, no, you shouldn't be scared of that. It's like, and I'll explain to you why you shouldn't be scared of it. It's like criticism or minimization. I tell people all the time, the of all of that, of choosing between those and another way of being reassuring is to say, if Tom tells me something, tells me something, he said, well, he's scared to death of having to talk to Patrick on the podcast today. It's really more reassuring if I just go like, ooh, that must suck. He knows I hear him. What makes it doable is the doctors always tell me the truth. The doctors, you're dealing with some of this with your knee. You've had surgery. We're all in trouble here. It's like, but Tom, you've had surgery recently. It's like we need people to tell us exactly what's really true. Don't give me some nicer version of it that I'm later going to be disappointed in. It's like, no, he said, no, I told you a while back, it's going to be at least a year before that starts to come back. It's like, all right, thank you. Hate the message, but love that I have that information.
If people can give it to me straight up, maybe implicit in that is that they think I can handle it, or that maybe there's a glint of an encouragement to kind of like embark on this shitty process, and you might come out on the other side.
Well,
Well,
it also helps us trust other people. Oh, that guy tells me the truth. When we're working our programs, we're telling each other the truth.
the idea that you have the capacity, right? Like you're feeling that way right now. There's going to be some work in this. There's going to be some pain through the process, but you have the capacity to come out the other side, right? That's the idea that the human spirit is very resilient, and we've seen evidence of this over and over again, that you can
Well, I
do.
believe it says I believe in you. It's like that's, and that's a message that we most of us have not gotten enough of. Try it sometime. Just when you don't know what to say and somebody's having a hard time, I do this fairly often. It's like sometimes I'll just look at somebody, get eye contact with them, and go like, I believe in you. It's like it matters, and it'll make a difference for people.
I don't know about you guys, but I believe in people because if I can conjure up just a little bit of belief in myself, which has been the hardest thing to do. I think, if I could believe just a little bit in myself, then I have no reason to believe, to not believe in the capacities of others.
Well, they've demonstrated it over and over again, especially in the recovery spiritual community, right? That there is such an immense capacity. One of the things which helps with forgiveness is that the examples I've seen, right? Like, so if you asked me at different points, I would have told you if I have had a horrible, traumatic childhood, right? And that's an objective observation. And I've heard speakers, recovery speakers talk about, worse, right? Much, much worse. And I'll go, oh my God, like, and listen to them now. And that doesn't change my experience, but it also gives me, like, oh, like each of us had the capacity to recover, in our own experiences. So it's both, not diminishing mine, giving me a little perspective, but also just again reaffirming the spirit of this thing.
I'm gonna stop and emphasize that point because there are people at all levels of recovery, all phases of recovery, listening to us. And it's this goes back to self-forgiveness, self-compassion. It's like this is one of the ways that we really, really hurt ourselves is when it's as soon as somebody has something worse going on, or even if in theory there are people who have worse problems than mine, then I no longer have a right to have these feelings. It's like, now when I tell people there, I go like, first of all, let's just follow that to its logical conclusion. It's like if as long as somebody else has it worse, then you don't have a right to your feelings. That means there's only one guy on the planet is that gets it. There are always people who have it easier than me, and there's always people that have it worse. That's just the truth. And that's going to be true for everybody except for that one guy.
My parents had a complicated relationship over time. They split up but stayed married. And when my mom was in recovery, she and my dad got sick. He was living outside the household, right? And she decided when he needed to, come out of rehab and be taken care of, she was going to take him home. She brought him home to take care of him. And I judged her for that. And I was like, what is she doing? He left her, he did this, he did that, and in a way resented her for her, making this decision. I was carrying that for a little while, and I went to talk about it with her and to make an amends for, because my resentments separate me from other people, right? That's bottom line. It's like it just distanced me, shuts me off from others. And so I'm making amends to her, and she goes, this is my way of making amends to your dad, that all those years of me drinking and behaving the way I did, this by bringing him home and taking care of him, even setting aside everything that had happened previously in our relationship, this is my amends process for him. And I was like,
Beautiful.
damn. Like, I had it all figured out in my head. Like,
Right.
I had her scorecard all written out and why she shouldn't do this. And she just went, what
No,
the
your damn is a beautiful thing. I just why this is an auditory thing, but people can't see your face, but it's just perfect. I mean, it's just like shit, I missed it. It's like
fuck?
there's some kind of ego involved in that too. I think they go like oh hell, I
Oh,
was
yeah.
wrong. I hate that when that happens. It's like, but it's but that again, it points to another principle of, and I didn't ever write that down as a principle of emotional sobriety, and I'm making a list of them these days. Hold on, boys. We got to get beyond the idea of you first. I owe Potash amends, but it's like he's never made the slightest effort. What's a good sponsor going to say? It's like, okay, what does that have to do with anything? And that's what your mom was doing. Her focus was not on amends that dad might have to do for her. No, that's not
Exactly.
my job. When we say what other people are doing, what other people think is none of my business, it really means none of my business. I need to basically have a little bit of tough love in with myself and be able to say, like, let that go, Rutledge, because that's not yours. Thanks for being here, Potash.
I'm a little concerned about the timing because last time I was here, it was about 18 months ago, and the Giants had suffered a devastating playoff loss to Philadelphia. And but we're talking about emotional sobriety and sports fandom.
Yeah,
and they're losing again. So I just, it's a pattern, I guess.
I would love to accommodate your superstition. So if next time the sports schedule happens to fall on a date that I'm trying to flag you down to be on the show, we'll do it on a different date. You know, I really want your guys to get where they need to get.
Well, if we waited for the Giants to win for me to appear in the podcast, it might be a long time.
All right, in that case, fuck it. Happy birthday to your wife. What's her name?
Christine.
Happy birthday, Christine.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.